Let's just look around at the formative stories of culture. If you're told you live in essentially a show about nothing, right? That's what life is. If you're told that all stories mask a play for power, that religion itself may be the ultimate propaganda con game, and the true hero now of this story isn't the heroic Superman, it's not the virtuous character standing for what is true, good, and beautiful. Mm. It is the anti-hero that can see through the facade.
Right, right.
There was this vibe shift in the 90s. Over the last few years, there are signs of a new vibe shift where people are going, I think I'm done with deconstruction. You're telling me all stories mask a play for power. That in and of itself is a story. So you get to the level of I'm seeing through, seeing through, seeing through. C.S. Lewis talked about this, right? To see through forever is to see nothing at all.
Welcome to Socrates in the City. The city in which I find myself today is New York City. This is a Socrates in the studio. My guest will be Paul Anleitner, or Anleitner. He's a religion and culture fellow at the Archbridge Institute. As a cultural theologian, his work focuses on the role of culture and story in our human quest for meaning. His unique interdisciplinary approach integrates theology, philosophy, and science to help individuals and institutions navigate cultural shifts and address perennial religious longings. He's appeared everywhere, Fox News, Federalist, CNN, Christianity Today, many podcasts. He's the author of a forthcoming book. We will discuss it today. It is titled, Based on a True Story, Vibe Shifts, The End of Deconstruction and the Reboot of Meaning. He has a Substack called Reading the Zeitgeist. I am very excited to have as my guest, Paul Anleitner, right here.
Welcome. Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it.
I am so excited. You know, when I discovered your stuff, I thought, we're going to have some fun because we obviously care about some of the same things. I have given a talk and I think written an essay called The Meaning of Meaning. Because to me, you know, people say, what's the meaning of life? And I think, well, part of the meaning of life is that human beings care about this thing called meaning.
Yeah.
Why do we care about meaning? What does that mean? So I know that's something you get into, but I always like to start with people's biography. I mean, you have this book here, Based on a True Story, Vibe Shifts, The End of Deconstruction, The Reboot of Meaning. How did you, Paul, get into this? What is your story? Were you raised in a home where people talked about these kinds of things? Did this come later in life? How did that happen for you?
You know, not to this level of depth per se, but I grew up, my parents were what they would consider first generation born again Christians, right? That was a term that was very popular in the 70s.
It's a term that I use.
Right, yeah.
I am a born again Christian. I think it's an term, you know, words are important, and that it really, it helped distinguish, you know, people in a sense that you say, no, I'm not just somebody who kind of grew up in a church, but like something happened, I was born again. But so you grew up in a home like that.
Absolutely.
And did you accept it, rebel?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is one of the core motivating factors for me in the subject matter that I write and speak about. You know, I'm what people might call a geriatric millennial or an elder millennial, a zenial. And so in a lot of ways, I feel like I was born into this world between worlds. We didn't have the computer in our house growing up. We didn't have the internet. But bigger than that, I grew up at an interesting pivot point in American culture, growing up in the kind of evangelical subculture of the 80s and 90s, youth group culture. I also saw, as I got into my teenage years, what I thought was just normal, right? It seems normal that when teenagers move into that phase of life, obviously they go through a phase of rebellion. And it seemed like the thing to do, right? Which is to go, I'm going to reject the story I grew up in, go explore something different. But then as I started to get a little bit older and got a little more of an academic interest in theology and philosophy, I noticed with a little bit of historical hindsight that what my generation had gone through was in many ways unique. So we'll say, for example, we can jump back to maybe the early 1990s. And in America, the percentage of adults that would claim to be what we now dub today as nones, N-O-N-E-S, non-religious, was under 10%, hovered between 6 to 9% for most of my childhood. But then something began to happen. When we get into the mid-90s, we begin to see this exponential explosion of those claiming to be non-religious. So by the time I'm an adult, one quarter to one third of American adults claim to be non-religious.
So non-religious, the so-called nones, are, that includes people who identify as atheists?
Yes, and agnostics. But the biggest slice of that pie is what we could call an even smaller, biggest slice of that pie is a subdivision we could call, I believe in nothing in particular.
In other words, they're not even willing to say, I am an atheist.
Right.
They just, it's kind of like a shrug. Mm-hmm. At least that's how I put it. It's sort of like a shrug. Nah, I don't know. But that is interesting, and that is dramatic. That is dramatic. So say more about that.
Even personally, I felt that pull.
Yeah.
Right? I felt that pull as I moved through my teenage years into my adulthood. I felt the pull in this sort of disposition of constant suspicion, cynicism, that seemed to be the cultural norm. And I saw a lot of people that had grown up in a similar background as I had leave the pews, not to become, you know, a Buddhist, a Muslim, but they were leaving for what they would say was nothing at all. And historically, that's very unique. That's not been an option on the table until really my lifetime. And so I've been very fascinated by what has been the spiritual shifts, the vibe shifts in you, if you will, in culture that has created this new category and has so impacted younger Gen Xers, millennials, Zoomers.
I've thought of this a lot, and it's so interesting to me because sometimes we think like, oh, the 60s was about rebellion, you know, and the 70s mm-hmm. was the continuation of rebellion, but something happened after that.
Yes.
That where cynicism enters in. You just talked about that. I think there's like an Eagles song. What is it? It's like, you know, and I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight with a million stars all around. Hmm. And you think, like somebody would say, well, that's like, you know, sex outside of marriage. Or mm-hmm. But it's still romantic and innocent with a million stars all around. There's something beautiful. It's not a cynical transaction.
No.
And I think that is interesting to me because that's what you're talking about, is that you still had people, they weren't hostile to the idea of beauty or innocence. Mm-hmm. They weren't cynical. So what you're talking about is
There's always been countercultural movements. I think that's what you're describing. If you go back to the 1960s, I mean, I'm not a Hegelian, but I do think one of the interesting insights of Hegel is that you do have these movements in history where the thesis, what was like the status quo story, the next generation comes into dialogue with that and attempts to challenge that. That's nothing new. But what was new, Eric, was the ideas that we saw in the academy in the mid-50s, early 60s, the postmodernism that was in vogue in the academy and the, maybe we could say, the high culture.
Yeah.
That, by the time we get into the 90s, moves into pop culture in a profound way. So here's a great historical example.
Yeah.
You can say, well, look at Woodstock 69. Obviously, countercultural. The younger generation is entering into a frictious dialogue with the previous generation. But you compare that to Woodstock 99, my generation's Woodstock. If you look up pictures of Woodstock 99 online, probably the first thing that you will see is the end of the Woodstock 99 festival, branded and marketed as the return of the peace and love. It ended in literal fire and ash. It looks like scenes from a foreign, you might see like a foreign war scene. what ended up happening in Woodstock 99, my generation's Woodstock, is that on, I believe what was this penultimate night of the festival, you get a band, Limp Bizkit, comes on stage, and they sing a song called Break Stuff. Most people that were there would point to that moment, and they go, something started happening in that moment. There were people climbing the speaker towers, trying to tear them down. By the final night, you had hordes of young people at the conclusion of the festival, roving the campgrounds, chanting a line from the Rage Against the Machine song, the final line in Killing in the Name of, chanting, F you, I won't do what you tell me, literally burning everything to the ground. That is a very different spirit, if you will, than what happened in Woodstock 69.
It's not Country Joe and the Fish.
No.
Yeah. Well, no, is it that you're, I mean, you're getting at what, and by the way, I just want you to know, I don't typically sing Eagles songs at Socrates in the City, but for some reason that line, it just sticks with me that there's something beautiful. And so when you think of the 60s and the 70s, that really was still there. It wasn't nihilistic. Now, we know that there were nihilistic elements and there were nihilistic voices, but generally speaking, in the cult, it hadn't trickled down into the culture. But you're saying by the 90s and whatever, a kind of, I guess, toxicity and cynicism and nihilism and kind of like a naked rage, I guess, comes into the picture.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe one way of framing this, and this is what I do throughout the book, is framing it within the lens of story and narrative. So if we consider one of the for the last 500 years, we could highlight 3 to 4 major stories. When I say stories, I'm talking about something that people maybe years ago would have said worldviews. But because humans are inherently storied creatures, I think it's more helpful to frame these as civilizational stories. You could take the traditional story of late medieval period, where you have a story about our place in the divine order is set by God, from kings all the way down to peasants. You don't challenge that order. Your job is to be as faithful and fruitful as you can within that little niche, whatever it is in the hierarchy. You are to be faithful. Mm. And if the king isn't, then God will depose the king, right? We have this challenge as we move into even the Reformation, right? So Martin Luther, I don't think many people would consider Martin Luther an Enlightenment thinker, obviously, but Martin Luther saying, you know what? I think the individual has access to God unmediated from these institutional structures directly through Christ. The impact of that thought, as you well know, Eric, is one of the most revolutionary ideas.
I believe... I may have written a book about this.
I think you did.
And I got to tell you, the only reason I wrote the book was when I discovered this, I thought, this is huge. This is epical. And it really is fascinating because, of course, that leads to, you know, all kinds of other stuff, including, I would say, the United States of America. I mean, it really leads to everything. It leads to the modern world.
Yeah, I mean, that revolutionary idea that the individual has access to God also means the individual has access to the truth, right? And the individual is able to see the truth up and against even potentially corrupt institutions that would obscure the truth. That is one of the most important seeds of what would become later modernism,
right.
Enlightenment, even the scientific revolution,
right.
is birthed out of that.
Yeah.
And so that modern story, what we could call the modern story or modernism, is so pivotal to American identity because it was in that womb, as you're writing another book about, you know, the American Revolution is born out of those ideas. The individual has direct access to God. There is such a thing as objective truth. And in fact, you may be even able to access objective truth using your faculties of reason. Right?
Now, see, what's interesting, I mean, in writing my book on the Revolution, I discovered these are Reformation Puritan ideas, but they've often been cast as Enlightenment ideas. Mm. And I think that they're not Enlightenment ideas. They are Reformation ideas. Yeah. They are Christian ideas. I mean, that's not escapable. It's just a fact. Mm-hmm. But they're kind of cast as Enlightenment ideas, as though reason or the desire to use reason exists apart from faith, which is obviously not true. And the Reformation thinkers and the Puritans knew that. So it's kind of interesting how people, you know, they grab onto the Enlightenment as a thing, as though it exists apart from
faith. I mean, it is within the Christian womb that these ideas are born out of. And this is, I know this is kind of a long way to get to this turning point in the 1990s, but it's important to understand how central then the modern story is to American identity. And so when I talk about even my own journey being born into a world between worlds, the modern story in popular culture was still the dominant story when I was born in 1983. And you can see it within the kind of icons of popular culture, right? You see these values in a Rocky movie, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And you see, it's wild to me. I mean, we could take a train ride over to Philadelphia and climb up the steps, and you would see a statue to a fictional character. Why? Because this archetype embodies these ideas that have become such a core
component. To be clear, because I was like in junior high when Rocky came out, it was already countercultural on some level.
Right.
In other words, Hollywood is moving in a certain direction, and then something like Rocky comes out. It's this huge surprise hit. But it was a surprise because it was already somewhat countercultural by being heroic.
Yeah.
By being, you know, it's kind of like Capra or something like it. But people respond to it.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated by part of what you're saying is the, you know, the waxing and the waning, these different themes. So there's this, you know, larger narrative.
Yes.
And then there's the ups and downs within the narrative.
Right. But, or we could see it as, you know, we've got these stories that we see in literature, film, and television, and they're nestled within these kind of larger guiding stories.
Right.
And that's, they don't stand on their own. Their values come from that higher story. So you take Rocky, right? And a Rocky story is tapping into that larger modern story, meritocracy, right? Not only does the individual have access to the truth, not only does the individual have access to the truth up and against corrupt or just non-competent institutions, you can pull yourself up. You can ascend. See, this is the challenge to the traditional story. You can be born into one particular strata in the social hierarchy, but you can climb that. I mean, that's the story. I mean, we see this in everything from Ben Franklin's autobiography to the autobiography of Steve Jobs. This is baked into our American identity, and we see it in this way. So I'm born into a world in which it is still that story at a popular level, sure, among the kind of high culture, among the elites, that had fallen out of fashion. But among the masses?
Yeah, the elites are cynical. I mean, the elites are cynical in the 1920s. But you're quite right. I mean, that Rocky story, it's the antithesis of cynical.
Right.
I mean, it's powerful.
And so you take that story, which was still in many ways the dominant story, the Christopher Reeve Superman when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, now we're going to get real lowbrow here, Eric. When I was a kid, I loved professional wrestling. And there is almost, among the art forms, perhaps no better art form that tries to capture the zeitgeist at the popular level in professional wrestling. The whole business is predicated on, can you read the crowd and what they want in real time? So as a kid, what do I get? I get Hulk Hogan, who's telling you, train hard, say your prayers, take your vitamins. It's the same thing as a Christopher Reeve, Superman, True Justice, the American way. I'm born into that world. But by the time we get into the 1990s, we have this, what we could call the anti-story, begins to move into culture. And so that same Hulk Hogan, by like 1996, is wearing all black with a shirt that says New World Order and telling kids, you know, that all that stuff I told you about training hard, saying your prayers and taking your vitamins, it was all a sham.
Are you kidding?
No.
I'm so glad I didn't follow professional wrestling because this is depressing.
But that's
that's very interesting.
Yeah, that's one little microcosm of them reading the zeitgeist in the 90s, responding to it in real time. But we see this all over the place, Eric. So not only that, as I move into the 90s, I mean, we're here in New York City, we even see shifts in the sitcom. We get the show about nothing, Seinfeld, right? And much of what we see in the comedy of Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld was deconstructing the previous sitcom formula and genre. And when you go back, let's say you take, setting aside his later legal woes, we'll take the Cosby Show of the 1980s. You go back and you try to watch the Cosby Show now, pre the cynical lens, pre the postmodern anti-story, and you go, it's really preachy. Did everybody believe that there were these objective values and morals? Every episode is some lesson about what? It's a lesson about meritocracy. Theo, get an education, right? I mean, that's every episode that Cliff and Claire are telling their kids, you got to get an education.
They're not telling him, you're a victim.
No.
You gotta rage against the man. They're telling him, get an education and you can be a doctor like your father.
And so how is it possible before, decades before our first black president, that we have the Cosby Show as a time where, you know, I kind of heard in the 2000s that was far more racist in the 1980s and 90s. But what was happening there, the Cosby Show was playing within the modern story. So these are characters, when we see the Huxtable family, that have ascended the ladder. By what? Through the game of meritocracy. But when we get to the 1990s, we see the deconstruction of even the sitcom in Seinfeld. And Seinfeld's one of my favorite shows of all time.
Well,
I'm not demonizing it.
Something can be brilliantly funny at the same time that it's partaking of what you're talking about. It's partaking of a larger story. But, I mean, even there's an innocence to Seinfeld in the sense that it's sort of making fun of that.
It's comedic nihilism.
It's not making a point, a bleak point.
No, it's not raging against the machine. It's a comedic nihilism. Mm. You know, it's the show about nothing. Larry David, he had this you know, famous rule on set, right? Every episode, there's no hugging and no learning. That was so different from pretty much every other sitcom, going all the way back to Leave It to Beaver and I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
And the characters don't display any virtue. In fact, you know, as we know, spoiler alert, it's been out for quite some time here. This whole series ends with the finale with all the former cast of characters showing up as they're on trial saying, these are terrible
people. To be clear, that was easily the worst episode. I mean, genuinely, it was like the worst. Don't watch it. If you can miss it, make sure you miss it.
Yeah.
But what I want to say, what I find interesting is that Seinfeld, a little bit like Woody Allen or Ingmar Bergman, they see meaninglessness, but they're troubled by it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not celebrating it or preaching it. In other words, they're not even preaching that. So you say there's no learning, but the Woody Allen, Ingmar Bergman, you know, the existentialist Camus, they still are sharp enough to be troubled by the idea that there's no meaning. So Seinfeld gets comedy out of that.
Absolutely.
But he is not preaching toxic nihilism.
No, and that's not my point isn't to say that Seinfeld is doing something bad. My point is to say it's a reflection of the spirit of the age.
Absolutely.
And something was happening. If you look at all of these little icons of pop culture during that time, there was a spiritual shift that was happening in American culture where the postmodern, you know, the influence of postmodernism that was in the high culture, in academia in the 60s, by the time we get to the 90s, it's moving into the mainstream. And so we get things. So 1999, Woodstock. 1999 was also Fight Club. 1999 was also The Matrix. By 1999, we're getting these influential, massive cultural stories that are telling us it's not just the comedic nihilism of Seinfeld. All stories mask a play for power. And the best response to that, the heroic response, the new hero in the story becomes the anti-hero.
Right.
So it's not the virtuous Superman anymore. It's the person that, what, sees through the lies of the system, is the one that rages against the machine.
The reason I make the point about Seinfeld is that they don't do that.
No.
In other words, they don't lionize that worldview. They're making fun of it. Mm-hmm. They're getting comedy out of it. But what you're talking about is people who elevate that worldview in a positive way. They're elevating a negativity into a positive.
Yeah, and maybe not even, you know, this might even be detached from what we could say is like authorial intention with these cultural texts. This is more about how it was received in culture. So you take a Fight Club, and you could make the case that Fight Club, in the end, wasn't actually trying to celebrate this, but the way it was received culturally among young men my age was what? Burn it all down. Project Mayhem, right? The Matrix, the way the Matrix was received might even be different than the intent. So what I'm more focused on is the way in which these stories are received in culture. And you get a clear pivot point in popular culture where this anti-story moves in. So this all ties full circle, Eric, to even my own personal journey. So when I look at why is it all of the sudden, we get into the 1990s and we kind of look at a chart of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, and we see around the same time this increase, this rise. It's like we're going up the roller coaster. Why is that? Well, let's just look around at the formative stories of culture. If you're told, again, you live in essentially a show about nothing, right? That's what life is. If you're told that all stories mask a play for power, that religion itself may be the ultimate propaganda con game, and that the proper response, the true hero now of this story, isn't the heroic Superman, it's not the virtuous character standing for what is true, good, and beautiful, it is the anti-hero that can see through the facade.
Right.
Why would I stay in church when I've been given a social incentive to be the one that says, you know, my pastor here, there are real tragedies in the church that young people, you know, I'm saying considering myself a young person at the time. I've seen messed up things in the church.
Yeah.
That's nothing new, though. You can go back to the first century. Yeah. You can see the church at Corinth. That's nothing new because people are messed up. What is different, and I ask myself, why didn't my grandparents deconstruct? Wasn't their church hurt then? Wasn't there suffering then? You know, my grandfather fought in World War II. I have to imagine he came back with some pain to process. The difference is the cultural narrative of my grandparents' generation did not incentivize cynicism, deconstruction. Our cultural stories did, and what it produced was a meaning crisis. A meaning crisis that we can see across multiple metrics. It's not just the emptying of the pews. It's not just that over the last 35 years, the number of those who claim to have no religious affiliation whatsoever. Mm. They don't believe in anything at all, has risen 260%. That's unprecedented in American history. Arguably, it's even unprecedented in Western civilization. It's not only that. We see dramatic spikes in self-harm, suicide. We see overdoses. You know, we have an epidemic. And that's why we get this term, you know, a friend of mine, John Vervaeke at the University of Toronto, I think was the first to coin this term, a meaning crisis, saying what we are going through right now is a crisis of meaning. He used another term, domicide. Domicide meaning the loss of home, the death of home.
I've never heard that term, domicide. Wow. Yeah, I was going to say, so where does this go ultimately?
So I got good news, right? The good news is, and I think there were even people back in the late 90s that were already plugged into the kind of intelligentsia high culture like a David Foster Wallace, who saw that postmodernism, in Wallace's own terms, was inherently patricidal, meaning that it was primarily a movement that was dedicated to killing what came before. Hmm. But that would create, according to Wallace's own words, it would create story orphans. And you can't live without a story. What happens when you become a story orphan? What happens when you've taken the sledgehammer of deconstruction? You're like, knocking down tradition, knocking down everything I believe, every story around me, is that you're left naked, alone, in the cold. So the good news is, Eric, and the good news, you know, why I wrote this book, is I am starting to sense in the same way there was this vibe shift in the 90s. Over the last few years, there are signs of a new vibe shift where people are going, I think I'm done with deconstruction. You're telling me all stories mask a play for power. That in and of itself is a story. So you get to the level of I'm seeing through, seeing through, seeing through. C.S. Lewis talked about this, right? To see through forever is to see nothing at all. The purpose of seeing through these beautiful windows in here is to see to something.
And Chesterton said something similar. He said, you know, I think it was Chesterton who said, you know, the whole idea of having an open mind is so that eventually you can close it down on something.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't just be, as you just said, constantly seeing through and seeing through, or burning down and burning down, because at some point you say, okay, and then what?
Like, yes.
Anything after that? Hey there, folks. For over 25 years, Socrates in the City and I, yours truly, have been having wonderful conversations with some of the leading minds of our time on the big questions. We think that what we're doing is important, and we need your help. Would you go to SocratesInTheCity.com/donate this month? This month, we're doing a matching campaign. All of your donations are doubled. SocratesInTheCity.com/donate. It's very important we get this out, what we do, to the widest possible audience, and your help makes it possible for us to do that. Also, while you're at SocratesInTheCity.com, please feel free to sign up for our newsletter and tell us what conversations you've enjoyed the most and what conversations you'd like to see in the future. Thank you.
I'm optimistic because over the last few years, I've started to see rumblings of a spiritual shift in our culture, especially among young people, especially among Gen Z, who have seen how, especially younger Gen Xers and millennials, have kind of lived in this meaning crisis, and they're exhausted. They're exhausted with nihilism.
Yeah.
And so there's an attraction. In some of the weirdest places, Eric, you can see signs of this. So I think one of the things that kind of drew larger audiences to my work initially was back in 2023. I started to see these rumblings. And I came out of the movie theater after a Top Gun Maverick, and I went, hang on a second. I came into that expecting, you know, Tom Cruise's Maverick character get the same treatment a Luke Skywalker got, right? Which is to say, the previous generation and their values, they're out of touch. It's all propaganda. We need to deconstruct the past. I was looking for them to do a takedown on Maverick. Instead, what did I get? I got actually a celebration of these core values, this heroism. It wasn't the anti-hero anymore. And that was one little sign. I was like, ooh, that's interesting. And not just that the film was made, but that it probably saved the movie theater coming out of COVID. I also started to see in 2023, I started to see rumblings of younger people. This is one of the weirdest things. We'll get real lowbrow again here, Eric. I saw rumblings of young people enjoying a band from the late 90s that had become dubbed the kind of butt rock music of the 2000s. They were the most sincere. They were probably the last sincere rock band of that era. And by the mid-2000s, as the anti-story moved through, they became the receiving end of all sorts of jokes. I'm talking about the band Creed. In 2023, I started noticing there'd always been these memes making fun of them, their syrupy sentimentality, their sincerity, that earnestness was made fun of, the religious undertones in their music. And then I started noticing young people posting on TikTok and on Instagram videos in which they were kind of ironically, sincerely enjoying Creed. And I started to track that, and I made a prediction that there was going to be in the next year a massive resurgence of interest in this band from the late 90s. I said that in the late summer of 2023. By the fall, news had come out that the Texas Rangers had busted their slump. They ended up winning the World Series. They busted their slump by pumping Creed's Higher in their clubhouse. They started playing them in the seventh inning stretch. I started noticing all over the place that young people were posting videos, not ironically making fun of, cynically making fun of,
right,
but post-ironically enjoying the wholesomeness of their songs and their lyrics. By 2024, Creed had, again, a band that's heyday with the late 90s and early 2000s, had its highest grossing year as a band of all time. They went back on tour. They topped the Billboard charts again. There was something that was going on. It's a silly, seemingly silly symbol, but it pointed to me that there was something going on where people were like, I want to get on the other side of irony. And instead of going wink, wink, yeah. I'm actually ready to just be like, I don't care what people think. I don't care if this isn't Radiohead or, you know, some band that people would say is better. Hmm. I want to just feel something wholesome, feel something earnest again. And all of these signs that there's this deep longing for earnestness, sincerity, for the wholesome, and even, this all connects together, to find a story that can contain what we need to have our innate longing for meaning satisfied. We could call like a story of stories.
Although that's kind of the point, you say our innate longing for meaning, that is to say that that is fundamentally important, because you know this cynical story or narrative that you're talking about seems to posit this idea that there is no such thing as meaning. Look, if you're looking for meaning, you're a sucker. And suddenly we get through to the other side where people are saying, look, whatever, I am myself longing for meaning.
Yeah. And that's innate, right? That's an innate. And I think there's some interesting research done, like my colleague Clay Rutledge at the Archbridge Institute, existential psychologist that has done for decades research on what was happening to the nuns as they left traditional religion.
Yeah.
And he was finding in his research that they didn't necessarily become less religious or less spiritual. They were just pursuing things like, you know, finding meaning in ancient aliens, UFO, tarot cards, all sorts of sorts of alternative spiritualities, because that is not something we can turn off. And so I think we're seeing right now a shift where young people in particular, this is a time where obviously you could be really, really cynical about the world.
Mm.
There's a lot of things to be cynical about, but I am so incredibly hopeful for what's going to happen over these next 5 years in culture, because the meaning crisis has bottomed out. And people go, I have to live in some story. So what story do I want to live in?
Right.
And not just me,
right.
Individually, let's take this out in a broader sense. What story on a civilizational scale is going to keep this whole thing from going Mad Max on us, right? And that's where I think you've seen a lot of interesting public intellectuals over the last few years have come around and gone, boy, I don't know what to make of all the metaphysics of Christianity, but I have this sense that it's only that story that is going to save us from the apocalypse.
I mean, I've noticed that as well. And yeah, some people have called it a vibe shift. You call it whatever you want, but it's obvious that it's happening. And it's dramatic. I mean, I've seen it. I mean, almost every day somebody else comes out as a person of faith or whatever, and you think, wow, like this is
something's happening.
Is clearly happening. And I have to ask you, I meant to ask you before, the title of the book is Based on a True Story, which is very, very clever title, Based on a True Story. But why, what is that title, Based on a True Story?
It points to the reality that humans are inherently storied creatures with an innate longing for meaning. We have to live in some story. Some story is shaping you. And those that even believed that they were nuns were being shaped by their algorithm. They were being shaped by the anti-story.
You can't escape it.
You can't escape that you are living in a story. You just might not be consciously aware of it. So the question I think this moment affords us is, what story can not only satisfy my innate longing for meaning, what story can band us all together in a civilizational project that keeps this thing, not just keeps this thing going, but makes for a better world for our kids, our grandchildren? And for that to happen, it has to be a true story. So I think we have an innate longing and desire, not just for meaning, but so that we don't get pseudo-meaning, false meaning, a mirage. It also needs to be a true story.
Mm.
So based on a true story is the sense that I have right now that these little rumblings in our cultural moment for earnestness, sincerity, we are seeing we're seeing an increase in among Gen Z and coming back to church, Bible sales increasing. There's these strange markers that something is happening, that people are looking for a true story to orient and situate their lives within. And so my invitation is to consider, maybe if we step back, we can kind of do the postmodern thing and go, yeah, I'm living in a story, one story among many. But then we could take a what we could call a beyond postmodern or meta-modern approach and go, all right, if I survey all the stories, maybe there's a story of stories here.
Yeah.
And that's something that Lewis, Chesterton all firmly believed, that there was an overarching story, an ultimate guiding story that all of the great myths derived their trueness, their goodness, their beauty from. And so this for me is an invitation to those that are coming out of the backside of deconstruction to go, I think, set down the sledgehammer for a moment. Let's start rebuilding, and let's start rebuilding around that story of stories.
Yeah, I mean, because at some point, if you say, you know, everybody's phony, everything's phony, everybody's hypocrite, and you know, you deconstruct and deconstruct and deconstruct, and then and you want to say, okay, and then what? Mm-hmm. Like what? So okay, so you tore down every statue, and you pointed out every hypocrite, and da 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 da. It's like okay, good.
Yeah.
Now what? Where do we go?
Yeah. And I tell a story of a friend named Tom. I call him Tom in the book. Tom's life arc, he went through a similar trajectory. I just so happened in my journey to stay within the church, and simply just by the grace of God. You know, I felt the pull. I never really had a moment where I left. I felt the pull of cynicism, etc. But Tom, after going through some difficult experiences in Christian context, had a deconstruction journey. And he got to kind of the end of that deconstruction journey. And he told me, I met with him at kind of the beginning and the end of it. And at the end of it, he's like, Paul, one of the things I realized is I get together. I still had this longing for human companionship, to be connected to community and others. I'd get together with my friends that had all deconstructed too. We didn't go to church anymore, but we'd got together. And every time we'd get together, we would just rail against everything that's wrong in the world. And I would go home and I would feel more miserable than I did when I came in. And I started to realize, I can't keep doing this, right? I cannot live. And the interesting thing that he picked up on, and so many other people who have kind of gone all the way through that deconstruction journey, got to the end, realized I got to have community, but how do we have a community around deconstruction? And they start to realize this, the deconstruction community does not work, because while you may band together around a shared enemy to rail against, to be cynical about, eventually you run out of external enemies. And the people you become cynical towards, jaded towards, want to see through, are the people you're staring eye to eye with. And so those communities end up self-destructing.
That's very interesting. When I picked up on that at some point in reading some of your stuff, and I thought it reminds me of, because I see it, you know, you could describe this as a spirit, and you see it in the French Revolution, that they are just raging against everything, the monarchy, aristocracy, the church. They're just raging and raging and raging. And I mean, many people know the story, but eventually they start eating each other. Eventually,
always.
No matter who you are, I mean, Thomas Paine is one of the figures in my book on the Revolution. I mean, he goes over there, he gets involved, and before you know it, he is in a dungeon, and he's being threatened with beheading. And you know, you can see it in history. You also see it with, I mean, in the Soviet Union, and Stalin, the cult of
how
Stalin.
How it always ends.
You see it that it's just like...
It's how it always ends. Yeah, I think one of the things that becomes perverse about it, right, is it plays upon what is a good desire for reform. Reform is good because reform has a vision of the highest good in mind and says this present experience, whether it's in an institution, in a relationship, isn't in keeping with the good. And so it has in sight a vision of the highest good and says there's a gap between that good and where I am. And so reform is good. This isn't about maintaining the status quo. I want to be really clear. This isn't about just going back in time and going, well, if we could just go back to the 1950s or the 1980s, everything would be perfect. That's an unhealthy form of nostalgia that makes the past an idol. It's also not doing the progressive move, which is to say moving away from the past in any direction is progress. That's insane. A vision of the highest good allows us to see the gap between where that vision is and where we are now, and we work to close the gap. That's very different than deconstruction. Deconstruction makes the inherent highest good the movement away, not towards anything.
Right.
So circling back to Tom, the good news about Tom's own story was the epiphany that he realized, I don't like what this is doing in me. I can't live like this. He was newly married. Him and his wife were realizing this is not, and they start thinking about children. Like, it's easy for someone else told me this the other day. He's like, one of the major epiphanies I had was, I realized it was easy for me to be a nihilist, but when I started having kids, I was like, I would never want my children to be a nihilist.
I mean, but that's what's so fascinating is that nihilism does not comport with reality. At some point, and having kids is the classic example, you bump up against the limits of nihilism. You say, I would never put that on my kids, a life without meaning. I want them to have hope. Yeah. I want them to have something. And then the question is there something?
Yes. Yeah. So for Tom, right? For Thomas, he got to this point where he's like, I don't know what I believe. But here's the thing. I'm willing to act as if this is true. Where else can I go? Right? And it's almost like the psalmist, if I make my bed in Sheol, you're there. And Thomas had gotten to a point, his wife's health had deteriorated with his mystery illness. They were in the belly of the whale. And he goes, I don't even know if prayer works anymore, but I've run out of options. Nihilism isn't working. Deconstruction isn't working. So what happens if I even try to pray to a God I don't believe in? And here's the paradox of that, is that it's a better indicator of what we truly believe and how we act. So by him acting as if, he goes in his head, like propositionally, I don't know if God is real, but I'm praying to a God I don't believe in. He is acting as if it were true. Right. And that simple thought, I don't know what I believe, but I'm going to pray to a God I don't believe in, was the thing that began to change everything. And he, you know what he picked up? He picked up a resonance with the wholesome. He picked up a felt sense. It was the vibe, right? We live in an information age where we are perpetually bombarded with endless information. It is too much for us to process. And so some ways, all the processing of different truth claims and propositional claims becomes too much for us to compute. And so especially younger generations that have lived in this, and they've lived in an era in which they are constantly being advertised to, what they've had to return to is something that we might call a noetic form of knowing. You know, it's a knowing that goes, hang on, I'm picking up on, so when he prays that prayer to a God he doesn't believe in, it wasn't like everything got better, but he felt a resonance with the wholesome.
It's so funny because what we are assuming, you and I, you know, is that there is something real. There is something called truth. There is that, even if you don't know what it is, or you've only seen hypocrisy, you still have to decide, so is there nothing or is there something? Yeah. And I think, I always think of Ingmar Bergman in his film, The Seventh Seal, that moment where the knight, Hans Bloch, is with this family and he sees the father and this beautiful mother and their baby and the sunlight, and they're eating wild strawberries and drinking milk, and it's like this so wholesome and beautiful. And you can see that that the night is it the moment pierces him somehow.
Yes.
If he can't make sense of anything else, something about the beauty of this moment, he knows it's not nothing. He knows it's a signpost to something beyond.
Yes.
And that is, it's such a powerful moment in the movie, but I think it betrays Ingmar Bergman's sense that, you know, I don't know what to make of things, and but somehow there has to be something. Why do I resonate with this moment of innocence? What is that?
And when you juxtapose it against the felt experience of cynicism and deconstruction, right? When you've lived in that long enough, when you go home from your kind of maybe ex-evangelical small group and you got exhausted by how cynical everybody was and that feeling, like you got slimed, and you juxtapose that against the simple, simple sense of like, I just had a moment of feeling something wholesome. And that's where, to bring it full circle, it's that same sort of thing that I think a young man that's gone, I'm tired of feeling cynical all the time. And he jumps in his Ford F-150 and he turns on a Creed song and he's blasting at the top of his lungs the most syrupy, sincere, hold me now, I'm 6 feet from the edge, and I'm thinking maybe 6 feet ain't so far down. Why is he doing that? He's yearning for even a little taste of the wholesome. And so that's what Thomas felt. Another friend, Jordan Hall, and tell you another quick story here, Eric. Jordan Hall was the founder of DivX, one of the co-founders of DivX, an early worker, a developer of the MP3 file. Jordan was kind of before Silicon Valley really became Silicon Valley. Mm. He was one of the brilliant minds. He made a lot of money, you know, sold his portion of DivX. And then he became fascinated in the 20-teens with what he called the meta crisis. And he started noticing that across multiple domains, that we had ecological crisis, meaning crisis, which we're talking about today. And he was fascinated with how to solve it. And so he traveled all over the world, meeting with all sorts of the best and brilliant minds, And Jordan found, very interestingly enough, he found himself after years and years of this journey, him and his wife moved to Black Mountain, North Carolina. Just small little town. He had done the LA thing. He had done all of the stuff. And he's sitting in Black Mountain, got invited to a neighbor's birthday party for their child. And while they were there, someone just said, hey, you guys want to come to church with us sometime? And Jordan described, and I write about in the book here, Jordan described that invitation as like, it hit me, but not in like an overpowering way. It felt a little bit like someone asking me, there's a really good ice cream place around the corner. Do you want to come get some ice cream? And so it sat with us positively, both him and his wife. And eventually they do end up going. And he realized, he's sitting in this little church, Black Mountain, North Carolina, and he started to realize everything that he had been looking for the last 10 years was there. People loved each other. They cared for each other. It wasn't like the threat of violence that was keeping one person in one pew from not killing their neighbor in the other pew. There was something else holding it all together. He felt a resonance with the wholesome. But because, I mean, he's probably a 165 IQ guy, his heart and his head had a little work to do together. And so he essentially describes how he has this internal dialogue with himself where his head is telling his heart, he goes, all right, you're feeling this and you like this. You think it's working, but you can't keep hanging around these people if you don't actually believe it to be true. So he said he spent about 6 weeks treating it like a startup, and he had done a number of startups. And he's like, 12 hours a day, I'm reading theology, philosophy, not just in the Christian tradition, but all over. Myth, right? The classics. And he gets to the point where his head suddenly catches up with his heart. And he goes, I think I better get baptized.
Wow.
And Jordan is, I just had an interview with him on my podcast just last week. Jordan is hosting incredible conversations in that space of Silicon Valley and those that we are also seeing in that sector, an interest in the spiritual. And it will be incredibly pivotal for people like Jordan in the months and years to come to be people that are, their lives are based on a true story, right? And they're oriented towards the good. And they're able to see the gap between the good and where we are. Instead of this cynical, let's burn it all, let's leave the system, all of that stuff. And they go, we will be the people that close the gap.
I have to ask you, I saw an ex post of yours, it might have been today, where you talk about the communist Chinese
yes.
figuring out, this is hilarious.
Yes.
It's like, hey, we've got a hack here.
Yeah.
Like these great stories from Western civilization, which we've had nothing to do with, they have a positive effect on civilization and on people. We have no story, I mean, except the toxic
yeah.
Marxist,
for sure.
You know, whatever story, which ultimately goes nowhere. And so say a little bit about that,
because
I was
so
fascinated
yeah.
at that.
I could hardly believe it.
Yeah.
Right. Because the Chinese government has done things. They get this. They understand the power of story. And so they'll even do extreme measures like 2011 or 2012. The Chinese government decreed that in primetime television, there would be no more time travel stories, which you go, that's really, really strange. Well, why? They were concerned about the underlying narrative of a time travel story presupposing that an individual could change history. And they go, yeah, we're not going to do that. And we also don't want you thinking about what good might have been in the past. So this is a culture that understands, maybe even in a way that we lost sight of,
right.
the power of story. And so when I saw that recently, I was fascinated because what they're, from what it seems like is happening, is they have understood that the stories that have become the foundation of what we call Western civ has given us a civilizational advantage that they have lost out on. And what is that advantage? Even if you go back in the, we'll say, pre-Christian past, which I'm of the opinion, similar to Chesterton, that we can see the evidence of the fulfillment of all of those things. You could go back to the Stone Age, as
yeah.
Chesterton argues,
yeah.
and you can see cave paintings pointing to Christ. But what they picked up on was the realization, well, what does the Marxist movement do? The Marxist movement, obviously, it gets rid of the past, but it also removes all vertical components of myth and story and flattens them all to the horizontal and the political. And they're starting to realize, well, hang on a second, there is something in our tradition which has not framed our cultural pursuits as merely being about material progress or a conflict among the classes, that we have historically, in all these different instantiations of Western civ, what has driven it all is spirit. It is a spiritual pursuit. It is the vertical. And so it's very fascinating. They're seeing the kind of deconstruction that's happened in America. And they're noticing, hang on, if that trend continues, this might be a civilization in decline. Well, how do we get a leg up on them? Well, maybe if we go to the fundamentals that they've lost sight of, and we go back to the myths and these stories. And if we do that, maybe we are building upon a narrative foundation that actually gives us, I hate to frame it as just within kind of game theory language,
yeah.
but a civilizational advantage. It'd be really interesting. I don't think, here's the interesting thing about myth, right? You can't really control it.
I was just going to say, it sounds like a great 5-year plan. But it sounds like it could backfire dramatically.
It would be interesting to see what it does
for them
within their civilization.
You're playing with fire because you're playing with truth.
Yeah.
Prometheus. If you want to play with a little truth,
yeah.
a little truth may lead you into more truth.
Absolutely.
And then you can't control that.
Well,
and how this, fascinating.
Absolutely. And this is why, I mean, I just so appreciate the conversations you have here on this program, because we, as you well know, Eric, we have been so completely saturated in a cultural anti-story that in many ways it does have its roots in the deconstructionist movements of Marx and Nietzsche. And we have had this, within the anti-story, this narrative that myth, religion, all of that is propaganda. And what it does, it's trying to flatten every component of the human experience.
It's bleak materialism.
It is. But here's the fascinating thing. Who knows what will happen in China? You know, I'm praying that the miraculous happens, because the thing that you can't control is when you open yourself up to the vertical, to the pursuit of the transcendent, that there's an old song we used to sing growing up, and I don't fully agree with the lyrics entirely.
Is it an Eagles song?
No.
Thank goodness.
No, no, no.
Thank
the
goodness.
Old, turn your eyes upon Jesus. And there was a line in there that the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory. And it's not that, and I'm not a Gnostic, the material world, but there is some truth to that, in that when you open yourself up to the pursuit of the true, the good, and the beautiful, you realize life can't be flattened in this way. It is not merely a zero-sum game of conflict. That is not what we're doing. That's not what holds all of this together, is conflict. It's not a powerful versus powerless story. That's a lesser story.
Well, that's, I mean, that's such a beautiful hymn, that turn your eyes upon Jesus. Mm. Look full in his, you just said it, look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. That is, I would simply say, true. Mm. That as you behold God in any way, or the good, or the true, or the beautiful, something happens. We're made to respond to that. And I find it funny that the Communist Chinese are so desperate that they would dare risk turning to some of these stories. I don't think it's going to go well for them, or it's going to go well for them, for the Chinese people, but not well for the Communist Party. Mm. I mean, because again, we're talking about a true story. We're out of time. Your book is titled Based on a True Story, Vibe Shifts, The End of Deconstruction and the Reboot of Meaning. Paul N. Leitner, a joy to speak with you. Thanks for your work and thanks for this time.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. I appreciate it.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.